When autumn nights brought the cold and dark, our forebears slaughtered animals and put away meat for their winter. It was the time of the blood moon. We now live in a world in which there is always meat available in the freezer of a supermarket. And since we now live in the well-lit world of modern times, some ask, can we please take the blood out of the blood moon? Well, can we?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 517th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Pucallpa who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Good morning.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
Folks, I have a little story to start things off today. A couple of years ago, I was visiting a tribe of people called the Shipibo down in the eastern Peru along the headwaters of the Amazon River. Now, the Shipibo live very close to the earth. There is no supermarket for hundreds of miles in any direction and no roads to get there anyway. And so all of the Shipibo's food must come from nature. I was in the company of some thoroughly modern Americans along on this trip who acquire all of their food from the gleaming shelves of modern supermarkets. There was much dancing and drinking of basato as our two cultures joined together there on the banks of the Rio Ucayali. And we had a lot of fun getting to know each other. But then came the chicken ceremony. With much deliberation, a rooster was staked to the ground with about 5 feet of twine. The Shipibo chief then handed one of us a bow and some arrows and said that whoever killed the chicken would be celebrated as a hero throughout the village. Well, those of us from America looked at each other and thought, oh my God, I don't want to kill a chicken. And so with much loathing, we went about the business of shooting arrows at this chicken until one of us finally killed it. It quickly became apparent that we did live in two different worlds, the Shipibos and the Americans, as the Shipibo longed for the death of that rooster because it meant that food was on the way, while we Americans loathed the prospect of killing that rooster because it meant that there would be blood on our hands. And so today we pause to ask, should we slaughter animals for food? Can we eat without killing? Can we take the blood out of the blood moon? Here to help us find an answer, we have Jessica Prentice, who is the author of Full Moon Feast, Food and the Hunger for Connection. Jessica, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back. So that little thing that happened on the banks of the Rio Ucayali down in eastern Peru in the headwaters of the Amazon, kind of indicative of what you write about in your chapter called Blood Moon, in your book, Full Moon Feast. Did it not kind of ring true?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, in that chapter, I'm really kind of grappling with this question. And I think what you experienced there is, you know, you saw the death, you saw the blood. And I think for most of us in America and in modern society, blood is shed for food, you know, for that boneless, skinless chicken breast that we see on the supermarket shelf wrapped in on a little styrofoam plate wrapped in plastic, but we don't see it. And there you had this very, you know, I mean, not only did you see it, but it was ceremonial.
Yeah, very much ceremonial, absolutely. Yeah. And yep, these people, the Shipibo people, you know, just by virtue of where they live very close to nature, and killing is part of their day-to-day lives, and having blood on their hands is part of living. And we Americans have somehow lost track of that. And because we lost track of that, eating meat is now becoming a controversial thing to do in many circles, right?
Yeah, well, and I think I should maybe start by saying I was a really strict vegetarian for 10 years of my life. So
Jessica Prentice was a vegetarian for 10 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So why were you a vegetarian, Jessica?
Well, I think for, you know, some of the reasons that you're bringing up, I was 14 when I became a vegetarian, a 15-year-old. I was a sophomore at high school, you know, sort of laid out all of the common arguments for vegetarianism. Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, my daughter, who recently went through high school, you know, kind of defined that process, and that is something that so many young people are doing now, is they are becoming vegetarians in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's complicated. It's one of those things where you're, for the first time, you're starting to define yourself and your values, and I think what happens is that we grow up in this culture where, you know, there's all this food, but we don't know where it comes from. We don't know how it grows. We don't know how it's treated. We don't know anything about it. That's true of the vegetable foods as well as the
right.
as well as the animal foods. But we know, at least theoretically, that with the animal foods, a life was lost. I mean, there it is. It's dead. It's on our plate. But we don't know any of those connecting factors, how it got there, how it was treated. And if we do start to learn anything about how it was treated, it's appalling how these animals are treated in factory farming, the vast majority of the meat that we eat. And so I think the impulse becomes to try to get out of that system.
Is that what happened?
Is that what happened
to you?
You don't want to be responsible. You don't want to be responsible for that suffering. You don't want to be responsible for that death. You don't want to be responsible for that pain. And you're, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old. You're probably also, you know, rebelling in some sense from your family. And, you know, you might say, oh, you know, here my parents, my mother, whoever cooks in the family has, you know, cruelly and unconsciously put, you know, this factory farmed meat on my table my whole life. I've been eating it my whole life. Now I get to make a choice, and I'm going to say no.
Is that what happened to you when you were...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think the other issues that, you know, that I, at least for me, were motivating were, you know, the environmental issues. We can feed more people if we eat lower down on the food chain, because then we won't be using our grain for cattle, et cetera. So it's sort of, you know, the ecological, the social, thinking about people in other countries who are going hungry, the cruelty to animals, just wanting to not participate in that factory farming system.
Mm-hmm. So what changed your mind?
Well,
you said you were a vegetarian for 10 years, so...
Right, so until...
Something must have ended the run, I guess?
Yeah, well, in my mid-20s, basically through my whole late teens and through college and my early 20s, I had really, really poor health. Poor health that was getting worse. And in my mid-20s, I finally needed major surgery. You know, and I was a young woman, and I had been very health conscious, trying to eat everything that I thought was right to eat. I cooked for myself. I was a quote-unquote good vegetarian. I ate lots of whole grains and beans and complementary protein. You know, I mm-hmm. matched it so that I would be getting my protein, and yet my health was really bad, and I was seeing acupuncturists for those health problems starting when I was about 19 or 20, and they always sort of encouraged me, you know, you need to start eating. Part of the problem, your problem, is that you're not getting enough animal protein. You need to start eating meat. And I just resisted for a long time, and I think finally when I had to, you know, when I found myself in a hospital with surgery in my mid-20s, I was like, God, no, I'm trying to do everything right, and here I've had, you know, I've been sick basically for 10 years. And then I was like, 10 years? 10 years. And then I was like, you know, exactly the length of time I've been a vegetarian. And I finally, it just kind of hit me like, I think I know what's best, but maybe I don't. And so I started eating meat again.
And what happened?
I started to feel better. You know, I really started to feel better. And I think that, you know, one thing that I'm very concerned about is this trend, because I think that that age, you know, that kind of adolescent, I mean, some people, mm-hmm. some girls in particular are becoming vegetarians when they're like 13, 12, years old, and then in your teenage years. And I think it's a very challenging time for the body because, you know, you're
all kinds of things are changing. Yeah.
All these hormones are, you know, are developing and you're becoming a woman. And I think it's a dangerous time to, you know, you're starting your period, so you're starting to bleed. And there's a whole body of thought out there that says that the reason that humans became omnivores, because no other primate, I think, is an omnivore. Very, very few.
Right.
The very few. But the whole reason that humans became omnivores and started eating meat was because of the loss of iron in the menstrual cycle and also giving birth and in breastfeeding, and that we needed the really accessible form of iron, mostly for women, actually. There's Leonard Schlein wrote a whole book.
So go out and get me some meat, boy, right?
Exactly. That's basically the thesis of his book.
Okay. Folks, we're on the Food Chain today with Jessica Prentice, who's the author of Full Moon Feast, Food and the Hunger for Connection. She's also a professional chef. And whenever I think of Jessica, I get hungry for some reason. Today we're working with some interesting questions. Should we slaughter animals for food? Can we eat without killing? Can we take the blood out of a blood moon? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Please do stay tuned. Water users, you can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and get rid of calcium carbonate deposits. No, not by magic. By installing an Aquamax catalytic converter in your water line that will induce epitaxial nucleation. Listen.
Hello, I'm Karen Kuhn. My father promised me that if I installed an Aquamax, I could grow grass where I've never been able to grow grass. And it's the truth. Was bare and spotty and is now deep-rooted and healthy. It's wonderful. We use much less water, and the plants look absolutely beautiful.
You can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and eliminate calcium carbonate deposits just by installing an Aquamax on your water line. No chemicals, no filters. Explore the possibility. Go to MetroFarm.com, click on the Aquamax Water Saver banner, and save. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the Blood Moon, a tradition of one of many food traditions in the late fall of the year. When the cold comes back and the dark comes back, our ancestors and our forebears used to slaughter their animals and put aside their meat for the winter. And it's a tradition that we've kind of lost because, of course, we live in modern times and meat is always available in the supermarket shelves. And so are we losing a connection with that blood moon? Do we need blood in the blood moon anymore when we are lost that connection with slaughtering animals? We're talking with Jessica Prentice, author of The Full Moon Feast, Food and the Hunger for Connection. And I guess that is a connection that we have lost there, Jessica. And before we move on to the tradition of the blood moon, we've got a comment on the board here, and we were talking about girls, young girls, and how they're kind of in concern for how animals are being treated. They're gravitating toward vegetarianism. And another thing we notice about young girls is that they starve themselves to death, too, to remain thin. So here you have young girls who are eating vegetables, living on vegetables, and living on less vegetables because they're trying to remain thin. So they're getting food really becomes a critical issue then, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And this happened to me. I mean, I didn't ever get diagnosed with an eating disorder, but I definitely was on that spectrum somewhere. And I read about it in my Hunger Moon chapter, my opening chapter, about how I didn't let myself be nourished at that time in my life. And it took me a long time to sort of get over that and, you know, be able to really be nourished.
Wow. Let's go to this tradition of the blood moon and tell us about it, okay?
Well, yeah, so it's the time right before winter, and in hunter-gatherer societies, this was the time of year when people would hunt. It's a good time in a couple of ways. The animals, you know, that a lot of animals in the wild are born in the spring, and by this time of year, they've they've matured.
They're
and
fat.
Yeah, they've
they're
got
fat.
The fat. They've got enough fat on their body. They're going to be more tender and tasty mm-hmm. than they would have been in the summertime. And so it's also called the hunter's moon, and it was a time of hunting. And on small family farms, generally you raised hogs. And I mean, we're talking mostly, on North America, European American, and Northern Europe traditions mm-hmm. here, though also Northern Asia as well.
So there really is a season for butchering, right?
So this is the time. So you waited till the hog got fat, and mm-hmm.
if you slaughter your animals in the spring, they're scraggly and thin and not very tasty, right?
Yeah, I mean some and you know there were some traditions around slaughtering a lamb in spring mm-hmm. or a young goat, but that's a little bit different then, and that was usually more ritualistic and more for a spring holiday. And also by the end of the winter you have the hunger moon and your meat had been running out, and so but the mainstay of the farmhouse diet meat wise would be hogs that would be slaughtered in the fall, and then it would be a big farm-wide affair to render the lard, put up the hams, smoke the bacon, smoke the sausages, and then that would really be, your wintertime diet would be those cured mm-hmm. pork products along with, your dried beans and grains, your sauerkraut, breads and cereal
Jesus.
Forages and sausages, and you wouldn't have very many eggs. The chickens would stop laying or lay very few. So pork was really crucial wintertime food.
Right. And thus the blood moon.
Yeah.
And when do we start losing connection with that blood moon?
Well,
I mean, that's the title of your book, Food and the Hunger for Connection.
Right.
And, just by virtue of what I experienced down in the Amazon, when we modern Americans met the very primitive Shipibo, and the Shipibo kindly tied up a chicken for us to kill. And we looked at each other and thought, oh, my God, we can't kill that chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the Shipibo people were going, please kill the chicken so we can eat.
Right.
We've lost a connection there someplace.
Yeah,
where did we lose it?
Well, it's so interesting. I mean, we lost it in industrialization, but I think, there's a wonderful scene, too, in the book Cold Mountain, where there's this rooster that's running amok on the farm where the upper-class woman has been sort of stranded by the Civil War, and this she's starving to death because she doesn't know how to grow food. She's so elite that she doesn't know the first thing, and her father dies, and she's starving there. And they send this sort of more, earthy peasant farm woman up to her basically to save her, and the first thing she does is, what are you doing about this rooster? It's flying in your face. It's harassing you. And she's like, well, I've tried to shoo it away. She says, shoo it away. What's wrong with you? And she just grabs it and cracks its neck. And she says, it'll be stringy, but that, it'll give us good broth, and she stews it up. And I really feel like I when I read that scene, I just felt like that was sort of a little microcosm for sort of, North Americans versus, the rest of the people of the planet, or, people mm-hmm. who don't live in industrial societies who still know how to feed themselves and know where it comes from.
Have we become so elite that we're like that woman?
I mean, yes, I think
have we city people become such elitist with respect to the food that we eat that...
Yeah,
we wouldn't know what to do with a rooster that was attacking us.
Yes, I mean, I think that's basically the case. I mean, we haven't, it's a society-wide thing, and it's happened through industrialization. All of that messy work happens in factories somewhere away from us, and it's interesting that even in our urban areas, many immigrant families still keep chickens and slaughter them. And I know plenty of stories of more sort of upper middle class people who, will maybe get a couple chickens for eggs, but then when the chicken's not laying so well, they can't kill it because they're, attached or, mm-hmm. Afraid, or they don't know how or whatever. And, we'll, ask, their, you know, cleaning woman or whatever to kill the chicken for them, and they can say, you can take it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we have become isolated and sort of sheltered from
this whole cycle. This elitism really is something that stems from the fact that we're isolated, right?
Yeah. I mean, it all happens in a mechanical, industrialized, mechanized system now, and you know, we just don't see it. And I think part of the point of my chapter too is that it's not only in the production of meat and animal products where animals die, but we also are, you know, we're disconnected from farming, and so we don't know that animals die in every aspect of our food system. You know, in the harvesting of grain and beans, and you know, and if we want to produce organic apples, we've got to kill a lot of gophers. And I think part of what happened for me and for so many people when they're young and they become vegetarians is that, you know, they don't have any connection, they don't have any experience of the whole system, and so you kind of get this idea that there is a way that you can live that doesn't involve death. And part of what I'm trying to say in my chapter is that I think that's an illusion.
Well, good. That's what we want to talk about when we come back. Can we live without killing? Is it possible? What do you think out there? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. I am Michael Olson. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're talking with Jessica Prentice, who is the author of Full Moon Feast, Food and the Hunger for Connection. Also a chef up in the San Francisco Bay Area. And, of course, we're talking with you, too. Pick up your phone and join us, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Something on the board, field mice die for vegetarians.
Exactly.
Right back. This is Michael Olson. Do stay tuned. When autumn nights brought the cold and dark, our forebears slaughtered animals and put away meat for their winter. It was the time of the blood moon. But folks, we now live in a thoroughly modern world where well-lit supermarket aisles always are well-stocked with the meat and vegetables and food, so we never have to worry. All we have to do for food is go to the supermarket. And yet, because all we have to do is shop in the supermarket for our food, we've really lost track to a great extent with our food chain and what it takes to bring food to our table. So we look at the ways in which we process our meat, we quite rightly look at it as being inhumane, if you will, to raise animals that way. So many of us ask, but can't we get rid of the blood in the blood moon? Can't we live without killing? Can't we go without meat? We were talking with Jessica Prentice. This is the Food Chain. Jessica, we're looking at this whole notion of it's cruel to raise animals in the factory farm situations that we do. And it's not an unreasonable, you know, thing to think, I guess, right?
I would agree with all the vegetarians out there that our factory farm system is an abomination, really. I mean, it's terribly inhumane to animals. And I think, you know, it's interesting. I actually feel now as an omnivore, as somebody that eats meat and somebody who goes to great, great lengths to connect with the ranchers, small-scale ranchers who are humanely raising meat and who, you know, I choose to pay good money for the animal products that I do buy and go out and, you know, see how the animals are raised, talk about how they're slaughtered and learn as much as I can about all the humaneness issues. I actually feel like I'm more of an activist on this issue now than I was as a vegetarian when I just kind of didn't want to, mm-hmm. you know, see it or deal with it. I just thought, you know, well, there's no death in my name, so I don't have to worry about that.
And what we do then, you know, when we feel and think this way, is we eat our way down the food chain to where there is no living thought. You know, where life isn't life. I guess, is that what we're looking for
I think part of the point that I try to make in that chapter too is that we have a very sort of hierarchical view of life. And, you know, in this whole conversation, the assumption has been that when we're talking about life and killing, we're only talking about animals. And generally the animals that we are, you know, that we don't want to be killed are the things that remind us most of us, you know, the cows that have, you know,
things that have eyes and look at us.
Exactly,
right?
that look at us. And I think one thing, one lesson that we can learn from indigenous and traditional peoples is a much more a sense that that the whole earth is alive and everything on the earth is alive. And so everything that we do, every breath that we take, is part of this cycle of life and death.
Well, let me kind of rephrase that, because, you know, in thinking about those Shipibo people down there in the headwaters of the Amazon, wouldn't it be harder for them to kill because they're always looking the animal right in the eye when they kill it, whereas we never see the animals that we kill?
Yeah, I mean, it's harder, and yet there's a... I mean, this is why so many cultures have rituals around doing this, is because there, you have to have some way of acknowledging this power that you take when you kill another animal. And that's why also there's usually a sense of blessing and a sense of you know, that this is a sort of sacred act, it's a spiritual act. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what we rebel against when we become vegetarians, or, you know, we make these choices, is that there's no gratitude in our approach to meat in this culture. There's no appreciation, there's no recognition that we are taking this choice, this power to take another animal. And traditional cultures always had some kind of recognition, some kind of appreciation of that, because it is very powerful. It's a powerful thing to do. And and then there would also be a ritual around the harvest time and you know, the vegetable plants, because they were important too and they were sacred. And
so a good part of this vegetarianism is simply the fact that we're escaping down the food chain to where we think things have no consciousness, right?
Yeah, I mean I do think there's, you know, it's a little bit tricky, because I do think that there is something very, you know, potent and powerful about taking, you know, an animal that bleeds like we do.
Right. There's blood.
There's something to that. So I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, it's all the same whether we, you know, mine salt or pull up a carrot or pick an apple or
eat a soybean out of a field
right,
with 30 million.
I do think that there's something very intense and powerful about animal products. I mean, even milk. I have a whole chapter on milk too, which is something that, you know, we take without killing the animal, but it's, you know, we're drinking mother's milk from a cow and we forget that, you know, it's just this white stuff in this, you know, box or bottle in our fridge, and we forget this is, you know, this is mother's milk, a cow's mother's milk. So there's something very intense about that relationship. There's some sense of kinship there with, you know, mammals in particular, but with animals that bleed. And so I'm not saying that, you know, it's all the same, but I do think that traditional peoples found ways to acknowledge this, you know, this death is part of this system. And also, many traditional peoples don't see death so much as an end. You know, they see life in a more sort of cyclical fashion. So death is a transition into something else. Mm-hmm. And so they found ways to...
Well, wait a minute. Go back and fill that one in a little bit for us. What do you mean by death is not an end, it's a transition?
Well, I think we have a very, you know, we have a very linear view of life in this society. And so, you know, we kind of see our life as a path that we walk, and then we die and we get to the end of it. And death in that context is, you know, we're scared of it. We don't, you know, we don't, I mean, this is sort of a, you know, a stereotype of even mm-hmm. going to a Latin culture, going to, you know, Mexico or whatever, where there's Day of the Dead, or Spain, where death can be approached a little bit more lightheartedly. And I think that's partly because there's more influence of a more sort of cyclical view of life, where death is part of the cycle, and it's a part that leads to, you know, rebirth and regeneration, and not just, you know, it's a line that ends.
And in nature, one sees a lot more of that regeneration, perhaps, than you do, you know, locked in a city where you're removed from nature.
Exactly. So, you know, if you live in a way that's closer to the earth, you tend to have that more cyclical view. You see that everything in dying gives its life to something else, and that's just the way that you know the cycle mm-hmm. works, and that death is a part of that cycle.
And you really see that in the Amazon. You know,
oh, I'm sure.
When things die in the Amazon, they don't stay dead for very long because they fall on the forest floor and everything rushes to disassemble them and the nutrients go right back up into the forest canopy.
Right.
So death is very short in the Amazon. I mean, life just is so powerful and continues and transitions all the time.
Right, life with a kind of capital L, and that's part of what I talk about too in the chapter, is that life, you know, when you look at it sort of philosophically, is this big thing, and a particular biological life ends, but life in the big sense goes on, even with, you know, absorbs that biological death very, very quickly, exactly what you're saying, and moves on to regeneration of more life. And I think it's, you know, in a sense, I hate to be kind of harsh, but in a sense, it's sort of a form of narcissism about ourselves, that we think, you know, that we get so attached to this life, and you know, death is such a big deal. I mean, I'm sorry, but this planet's been, you know, going for millions of years, and hopefully will go for millions of years again. You know, and death is just a part of the picture. So we might as well accept it, and then we can get to the really important work, which is that, you know, we have ecosystems that are suffering because of our impact.
The real important work. Before we go to the real important work, let's talk with Scott, who wants to talk about sharing life. Scott, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael. You're talking with
Jessica Prentice. Go ahead.
Jessica, as the poet Bob Dylan put it, death is not the end. You know,
Uh-oh.
I was a vegetarian.
Scott, can you hold on for a minute? I hear
Hello?
The music. Can you hold
oh,
on
sure.
for a minute? We're going to have to take a quick break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking with Jessica Prentice about the blood moon, the blood in the blood moon. And since we've moved away from the farm and moved away from our food chain, a lot of us are now looking at the blood in the blood moon and thinking, isn't there some way we can get away with life without having to kill for it? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back out there. This is The Food Chain. We're talking about the blood in the blood moon with Jessica Prentice, who is the author of Full Moon Feast, Food and the Hunger for Connection from Chelsea Green. Great read. Pick it up and get in on one of Jessica's dinners if you can. Somewhere in San Francisco, right, Jessica?
Berkeley, yeah.
Berkeley? Well, I want to get in on one of them sometime, so.
Great. It would be great to have you.
We're talking with Scott. Scott, are you still there?
I sure am.
Good.
Thank you.
We're talking about sharing life, so fire away, Scott.
I think, first of all, I was a vegetarian when I was 14 or 15. You know, for the same reasons, guilt mostly. But actually, I learned that vegetarianism, for moral reasons, is actually foolish because it's a value judgment that animal life is more precious than plant life. I think to the plant, probably its life seems more precious. But, you know, our very intelligent designer designed us to kill to live, and that is a perfect system. And while being a vegetarian, I learned during yoga, under Maharishi Gautama, the philosophy and practice of yoga, I learned that everything you consume lives through you. I could feel all the broccoli and cauliflowers. I could feel their life. They're actually is shared through us. So when you consume a lower being, and we're talking about the food chain, humankind is always at the very top. And whenever you consume something lower than you on the food chain, then it becomes a higher being. It becomes part of a human being, which is, I think, the greatest thing for anything. Also, since
that's an interesting notion, Jessica.
Well, I mean, the notion of a food chain and a hierarchy, I think, is sort of part of that linear thought.
And sometimes we're not at the top of the food chain.
Yeah, I mean, it's worms that eat us afterwards, and maggots and bugs, and you know, we're part of a circle. And I mean, I think that I do think it's an interesting this whole idea of, like, you know, trying to figure out, well, what does the animal want? You know, does the animal and there is in Vedic philosophy this whole idea that an animal that's taken in with the proper in sacrifice in the proper sort of ritualistic way moves up in its reincarnation and its cycle. So
you were speaking earlier, and also the Indians would speak even to the spirit of a tree before they praised it, you know, because they're choosing it to build a canoe.
Right. No, I mean, I think that's such an important point, is that, you know, everything that we do takes life. Living takes life, and that what I feel like a lot of the the sort of the choice to become a vegetarian or a vegan is sort of a symptom of the lack of gratitude in our society.
Well, it is also definitely a form of kingdomism.
What do you mean by kingdomism?
In other words. I won't slaughter within my kingdom, the animal kingdom, but outside my kingdom, in the other kingdom, I'll slaughter even to eat an apple, you're eating the ripe ovary of a tree. It's reproductive organs, you know. So you can't get away from killing.
Right. I mean, that's precisely the point.
And let me ask both of you this question. It seems to be the real problem here is caused by our distance from our food chain. Is there a solution, given the fact that we live in cities now and we get our food out of the gleaming shelves of supermarkets? Is there some kind of solution to this distance problem? Scott, what do you think?
Well, first of all, yeah, when I say the top of the food chain, I just mean we're the only being that consumes absolutely everything. I have a friend from Kenya, and he lives in the bush, very close. And they would consume their beef without slaughtering it. They took an arrow, and about a quarter of an inch down, they tied a rope. And then they got underneath, they held the animal, got underneath, they shot it in the jugular, and then pulled the arrow out. And as the blood came out, they stirred it. And what coagulated, they fried. And what remained liquid, you have to stir it or it all coagulates. What remained liquid, they mixed with milk, and that was their source of protein. So you can do it. And these were very primitive people. He said when they castrated the bulls, for example, the men really enjoyed it. But I would think that we need to be more compassionate. You know, I would rather see, I mean, I've been in a slaughterhouse before, and it's not that bad, but it would be nice if we could put up some sort of system where the cow doesn't know what's happening, and that the people that slaughter it can be nice to pet it and just whack it.
That's what we're going to pick up when we come back, and that's the way we'll end the show. Thanks for your call, Scott.
Yes,
folks,
sir.
This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Jessica Prentice. We will be right back. Do stay tuned. What about it out there? Can we take the blood out of the blood moon? Can we live without killing? This from Full Moon Feast, Food and the Hunger for Connection by Jessica Prentice. On the Blood Moon, may we say a heartfelt prayer for all the animals who are being raised in inhumane conditions. May we give a great thanks for the farmers and ranchers who treat their animals with respect and honor and who care deeply for their welfare. May we take the time to seek out sources of animal foods that are raised with respect for the environment, for our health, and for the well-being of the animals themselves. May there come a day when factory farms have been replaced with small-scale, integrated, holistic family farms where all living things are recognized for being the gifts that they surely are. May there be a day when Americans have acquired the adult knowledge that all life is dependent upon all other life in an endless circle of giving and receiving, birth and death, growth and decay, rebirth and regeneration. May we find ourselves humble as we contemplate the miracle of life and of the life that transcends death. That would make our ancestors proud. So, will that day come sometime soon, Jessica Prentice?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, it's been a very, in just the 10 years that I've sort of been working with these issues, I've seen a huge growth in interest in small-scale ranching and humane animal husbandry, and there's lots and lots of people out there that are really making a big effort in their lives to seek out these humane sources. So I'm hopeful. I see that the trend is that way, and the factory farm system is, in my opinion, unsustainable. So it will collapse sooner or later, one way or another. Our consciousness will be part of that process, but I think there's also material forces that will bring it down. And so I really choose to sort of put my energy into the kind of farms and ranches that I want to see thriving, and that's where I put my money and mm-hmm. and my time and my attention.
Well, what can we city people do?
Oh, there's so much. I mean, you can start by going to a farmer's market, and, you know, often there's meat products there, and going and talking to the people there, finding out more. Most of these small-scale ranches, wherever you live, have websites. A lot of them do, and they usually have pictures of the animals, and I just think it's, you know, even that, just taking a few moments to go and kind of surf and on the web and look at who your local humane ranchers are is bringing yourself back into connection. I mean, even just looking at the animal there. I did a full moon feast out on a farm a couple of weeks ago, and it was on a grass-fed beef ranch in Marin County. And we ate this dinner out in the field. We had braised beef, we had some raw beef, and we had grilled steak, and just on the other side of the field were the steers that were going to be the next the next meat. And I was a little bit nervous beforehand. Well, you know, our people, like Americans, you know, we want to hide our head in the sand about this, but everybody just really loved that sense of it's real, you know, it's real, and I'm taking responsibility.
Well, what would you tell those 16-year-old high school girls who are so concerned about, you know, eating animals that are raised in factories? What would you tell them?
Well, I would first tell them that I am too, and that we really share that. I mean, I think it's very hard because that whole process is about, you know, individuation and coming up with your own ideas. I mean, I do hope. I know that a number of people have ordered my book and said, I'm giving this to my 16-year-old daughter or whatever. And, I mean, that was in the back of my mind as I was writing the book, was hoping that there might be, you know, girls and boys out there in those sort of moments in their life where they read and they say, okay, well, you know, this person agrees with me about all these things being bad, but, you know, she had a lot of problems making, you know, when she made this particular choice, maybe there's another way I can do it. And I see a lot of young people, not teenagers so much, but people in their 20s who are very, very committed to this and are, you know, understanding just.
Well, Jessica, thank you. Thank you so much. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Jessica Prentice, for joining us. And thank you all out there for tuning in. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen.
Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.